today's show, 9/11 Blueprint, The Architecture of Destruction. Richard Gage is an architect, a member of the American Institute of Architects, and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He is the originator of the Take an Architect to Lunch outreach program of 9/11 education for building professionals. He has been a practicing architect for 20 years and has worked on most types of building construction, including numerous fireproofed steel frame buildings. He is employed with a Bay Area architecture firm. Richard Gage has prepared a two-hour audiovisual presentation on the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7 destruction that took place on September 11, 2001, and makes a strong case for controlled demolition. We discuss his new organization, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and his two-hour presentation, How the Towers Fell. Richard Gage, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. It's great to be here at KPFA.
Well, welcome. It's good to have you. Richard, you're the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. How did you come to form this organization?
Well, that takes me back over a year. I was on my way to a construction site, and I heard on the radio, guns and butter as a matter of fact, you were interviewing David Ray Griffin, the Oral Histories. And I heard things that I had never, ever heard before, and what alluded to something big that happened at the World Trade Center. And I was literally shocked. I had to pull over on the street and listen to the rest of the program. And David Ray Griffin, for instance, he was talking about the oral histories, which we'll have to get into, where 118 firemen, for instance, and other first responders were recorded, and they all talked about explosions in various places, various times, many coincident with the actual building collapses of both the North and South Tower, as well as what happened after those sounds and flashes of explosions, beams individually dismembered from each other and hurled laterally 500 feet. It went on and on and on, and we'll talk about that today. But I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I went home, I got on the internet, and I said, man, there might be something to this. So I just looked at it, and over a period of 3 or 4 months, I realized I have to form the organization Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, because there was already an organization, 911truth.org. So now we have AE911truth.org, and I've dedicated my life to waking up every architect and engineer in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond. And, of course, along with that, the rest of the American people. So our mission is to reach every architect and engineer in the Bay Area and beyond, and to get a new investigation of all three World Trade Center high-rise collapses on 9/11. Many people don't know about the third one, a 47-story skyscraper that would be the tallest skyscraper in 33 states today. It fell down, it collapsed, if you will, in virtually free-fall speed in 6.5 seconds, symmetrically, smoothly, in the classic manner as of a controlled demolition. So we want an investigation in Congress with subpoena power and an unimpeachable investigation. The 9/11 Commission could not be phrased an unimpeachable investigation.
So, Richard, tell me about Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Now, this is an organization that you founded, and architects and engineers can join it, right? How does that work?
Well, actually, everybody can join, and it's as easy as going to our website, ae911truth.org, hitting the join button, and then we'll ask you, are you an architect or engineer? If so, what are your qualifications? And we'll ask for those qualifications. If you're not, you go in a different category, others. So right now we have over 150 architects and engineers, and we have, I think, over 330 in the other categories. We expect within a year to have 1,000 architects and engineers, and this will, we believe, really turn the heads in Congress. We already, as a matter of fact, have a request to have a hearing, a formal hearing, at the House Senate Intelligence Committee with Henry Waxman. So that is in place. There is a lot happening, and we're getting busier and busier. And we work full-time during the day as architects and engineers. So there's just very little time to do what we have to do. It's like having two full-time jobs.
Well, now, Richard, I was going to say you're currently employed at an architectural firm here in the Bay Area. What kind of architectural and or engineering projects do you work on? I understand you've been working as an architect for what, 20 years?
Yes. I was licensed in 88, and I graduated from the University of Southern California in 86. And I've worked on most types of construction before concentrating on the construction documents and construction administration. Right now, we're working on a 1.2 million square foot retail downtown area in Nevada with 360,000 square feet of high-rise office and additional parking structures. And all of that will have, something like 1,200 tons of steel framing. So I'm involved in the management of that project.
Now, have you been involved in the design of steel frame buildings in the past?
Steel frame fireproof buildings have probably constituted the majority of my work, yes.
Now, you give presentations to the public, and I also understand that you give presentations to architects and engineers. So could you talk about these presentations? For instance, like how many have you given to the public, and maybe how many to professionals, and how do you do that?
Yeah, well, what we do, our members donate to buy lunches at the architecture firms and engineering. And, in fact, people, if they want to help us, can go on to take an architect out for lunch. That's our banner. And you can buy an architect a lunch for $9, and we'll feed him the 9/11 truth. We'll go through all the evidence that we're going to go through here today. So we go into the architect's offices, and, for instance, the first one I gave in Walnut Creek, we had 15 architects, 14 of them signed up, and they were all skeptical. Everybody there except me, where I worked. 14 of them now have signed up demanding of Congress a new investigation. I went into another firm of 60 architects. 38 showed up to the presentation. Most of them agree that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition. At a minimum, they readily agree, virtually all of them, that there are serious problems with the official investigations. That is to say, the Weidlinger report, the FEMA report, the American Society of Civil Engineers report, and finally the NIST report, or National Institute of Standards and Technology. We'll get into that. So my goal is every other Friday to reach a new architecture and engineering firm. Now, we've also, we get invitations all over the country to speak, and outside the country. I've been to Winnipeg, in Canada, in San Diego, and Chico. We're going to Hartford, Connecticut, coming up in, I think that's in November, and New York. We have two presentations the week of 9/11, and we will be going to Indiana on September 10th with Kevin Ryan and Stephen Jones, and then back here to the Grand Lake Theater here in Oakland, Tuesday night, September 11th. Where we lay out all of this evidence that we're going to be talking to today. We've invited every architect, that is, who is a member of the American Institute of Architects, so we hope to have a good number of building professionals showing up.
So you've invited architects to the September 11th event in the evening at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, we're going to have quite a crowd. Now, when you say that you're traveling around and giving the presentations, now, you're referring to presentations to the public, right?
Yes, and wherever I go, I encourage the local supporters to get out a letter campaign and a phone campaign to all the architects and engineers in their area. San Diego is another example. October 14th, we'll be getting out a massive letter campaign.
Now, when you give a presentation to specifically to architects and engineers, you go to their firms during lunch hour. What do? You go into one of their conference rooms and give a presentation?
Yeah. And architects and engineers are accustomed to this. Reps from different manufacturers of building materials and systems routinely go into the firms and buy them lunch, and that's how you get them there. And in this case, it's an educational seminar that we present about the Twin Towers, a fascinating subject by any right. And then we begin to present the information that David Ray Griffin was telling all of us about on your radio show over a year and 4 months ago, I think.
Now, what kind of a reception have you gotten at these firms? It sounds to me like you've been well received. Has there been much resistance to you giving these presentations?
No. I think there's a natural resistance emotionally, because this is uncomfortable material. We're stepping on the dark side of our national conscience here, because right now, most all of us agree that these buildings were brought down by the airplanes, which were filled with about 10,000 gallons of jet fuel, and which caused fires, which after about an hour softened the steel and caused the columns to buckle. And we'll go through that scenario, but basically then the building just collapsed into its own footprint, they say, in the case of the Twin Towers, which isn't the case at all. So
you're talking here about the official explanation of what happened.
Yeah. So when you begin to look at all of the evidence, and I'm not saying evidence that we've manufactured, I'm talking about the videos, the photos, the interviews of the first responders, it paints a very different story. And this is why the 9/11 truth movement is growing by millions every year. There's a poll, Scripps Howard, Ohio University, I think it was, that in 2006 showed about 16% of the American people actually believe that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition. That's an astonishing figure. That's millions and millions. And it's growing all the time. And we have no personal stake in going out and creating a conspiracy theory where there wasn't one before. This is very painful work. There is emotional resistance. I have been called a kook on a few occasions, but every time I've sat down with somebody and gone through this evidence that we're going to go through to a person, they agree, wow, I didn't know about that. I didn't know about that. I didn't know about that. Well, why? Our media is not allowing this information to come forward. There are very few interviews of people who are scholars and building professionals that have really looked at this evidence and will lay it out. So that's why I have to go around the country speaking, and that's why at the Grand Lake Theater, I'm going to take great pains to make it as clear and as simple as possible with video clips, audio clips, and photographs, so people can, with their own eyes and their own ears, can see and hear what's going on and why they have to take a second look at this. Because our first impression is to say, oh, that couldn't have happened. I would have heard about it by now, eh? Or that could have never happened. They couldn't have kept it secret. It's too big of a conspiracy. Or the administration bungled Katrina, and you're telling in Iraq, and you're telling me that they pulled this off? No way. So all of these are our first-hand excuses to wave off and dismiss what we do not want and can't afford to believe is true. And I just have to take people into the evidence, and then I have to help them confront the evidence and move beyond it and move beyond our fears, really, that come up. Let's face it, Al-Qaeda did not have access to these buildings to set these charges that we're going to be talking about here in a moment. So if not Al-Qaeda, then whom? And when? And how? And more importantly, why? Those are extremely serious questions. And as architects and engineers, we shy away from them for very good reason. Our line of credibility extends to and through the evidence. Beyond that is speculation, and it is exactly the reason why we need an independent investigation as soon as possible. Because if this was done, for instance, by members of our own government or private corporations in league with government, then why was it done? I mean, we know that it served as the pretext, for instance, to get us into Afghanistan. We know Iraq was based on a pack of lies. Well, what else do we not know about Afghanistan? Well, it turns out, if you really look at it, there's plenty of information out there to paint a different picture than we hear on the mainstream media. And what's all the saber-rattling about Iran? And I'm very concerned about another type of 9/11 and what that might be the pretext for. So all of that gets past our mission, though. So.
I'm speaking with architect Richard Gage. Today's show, 9/11 Blueprint, The Architecture of Destruction. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, Richard, one thing that I have found curious for years is I would have thought, looking at it logically, that architects and engineers would have been among, structural engineers, for instance, would have been among the first to have recognized a controlled demolition, to have thought, to have seen that something was up, that something wasn't right. And yet it seems like the professionals themselves are the last to see it. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Excellent. Because in the case of Building 7, what we see, and I described very shortly earlier, a classic case of controlled demolition that whenever anybody sees it, they can readily reference it as such, because we've all seen it on TV and so forth. So the problem is that we don't see it. 95% of the architects and engineers that I talk to, and regular normal people, non-building professionals, have never seen Building 7. So as soon as you show it to them, they go, oh, my God. I mean, I just did a presentation at the American Institute of Architects, the Oakland office, the East Bay chapter, and we had architects going, of course, that's a controlled demolition. It has a classic kink in the middle, which pulls the exterior of the building inward so as not to damage the other surrounding buildings. It has classic squibs or mistimed explosions on the 40th through the 47th floor that are easily seen, poof, 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 in dark smoke that can only be explosions, synchronistically timed floor by floor. And it has the classic free fall collapse. And the only way that can happen, and symmetrically, is to remove the exterior columns a fraction of a second after the interior, which is why, by the way, the penthouse falls first and there's a kink in the middle, and then synchronistically time floor by floor the whole, you remove the columns so that it comes down perfectly symmetrically at free fall, virtually free fall speed, 6.5 seconds. So building professionals recognize that when I show it to them. That's why I start with Building 7. And by the way, there was tons of molten metal found at the base of Building 7, which is not a classic component of controlled demolition. Controlled demolition usually starts with charges because they're not worried about hiding the explosions. But if you want to blame a building failure on fire, you're going to use a form of incendiary, which is more silent, like thermite, for instance, which the military uses to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And the byproduct of thermite, by the way, is molten iron. And the firemen described tons of molten iron flowing like lava, they say. And you can, by the way, you can see all of this evidence on our website, ae911truth.org. And you can hear the firemen discussing this molten iron on the video.
Richard, let me ask you this. So, okay, Building 7... And maybe professionals didn't see that, but they certainly saw the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And, of course, the planes went in, and that kind of muddies the water. But why wouldn't professionals, what do you think it is? Why wouldn't professionals have thought that something was up at the Twin Towers? Or well, did they, and they're just not saying anything?
Well, no, I didn't, and I don't know very many who did, and I'll tell you why. First of all, very, very, very few structural engineers even are trained to see controlled demolitions, trained in controlled demolitions. The the Twin Towers present a whole nother scenario where we don't have a classic implosion. What we have is a first in an explosion, top-down controlled demolition, starting at the point of the impact. And the firemen described these explosions and flashes of light in the oral histories that were secured by the New York Times in a lawsuit and won by the Court of Appeals, forced the city to release these. And now we know why the city was trying to hide these, because these 118 cases of firemen describing the flashes of light and explosions going all the way around the building like a belt, and then this incredible outburst of pulverized concrete and dismembered columns and beams in this huge mushrooming cloud. This is not a classic controlled demolition. This is more like a volcano explosion like Mount St. Helens. There was a buildup to this. There were hijacked aircrafts. There was a huge explosion at the Twin Towers. We didn't know whether it was a terrorist attack or some plane gone off course. Then we find one thing after another, and then there's another plane at the Pentagon. And we're in a state of shock. So we're fully prepared to kind of accept what comes next, which came right away on the radio and TV from the experts, if you will. Jerome Hauer, for instance, who's not really an expert at anything other than presenting right away the false story that the steel softened. He's not even a structural engineer. And due to the tremendous heat from this airplane, these airplanes, and it had the classic fingerprints, he says, of Osama bin Laden. So they laid the roots for this story. So we're kind of going, as architects and engineers, looking at this, okay, it's completely out of the realm of our experience and our training. So we simply bought the results of the investigations from these groups, such as the American Society of Civil Engineers, who are, you know, they're structural and civil engineers. They're trained at what they do. We want to trust them. Problem is, they're not volunteers, really, not like your PTA volunteer. These are highly paid individuals who had worked for the government previously and had ongoing contracts and with at least $10 million.
Now, you're referring to the reports that were done, the FEMA report, the NIST report, the National Institute of Standard and Technology. The owner, Silverstein, he had a report made. The ASCE, were there four or five reports?
Yeah, I count four. The American Society of Civil Engineers report was first, and it had actually the same cast of characters wound itself through all of these reports. Gene Corley and Therese McAllister, all of them have conflicts of interest, defense contracts, and so forth, dealing with blast and
so you're saying that the same people produced all four reports?
There was a few changes of characters. John Gross comes in with NIST and basically denies that there was any molten metal in the NIST report and actually hides the evidence that FEMA came up with earlier about intergranular melting of the ends of the beams, which fire doesn't do, by the way, and sulfidation and rapid oxidation that the New York Times called the greatest mystery of all in 9/11, how these beams could be completely dismembered from each other, the column beam connections. This is a moment-resisting frame. These are welded connections. It's the strongest point of the building, and yet that's where they all failed because they're cut. In fact, you can see plenty of 45-degree angle cuts, which is a classic shape of in controlled demolition so that the columns can slide past each other after they're cut. So that's the reason that we didn't understand it.
You mean because you think everybody, that professionals were programmed right along with the rest of the population to see it a certain way.
And whenever you get, almost without exception, an architect or an engineer to sit down and go through this evidence as carefully as we have, and Stephen Jones, for instance, has laid out some very, very important evidence we'll talk about, they sign up. I mean, how did we get 150 architects and engineers signing up on our website since Memorial Day? I think it's 4 months.
Well, now, Probably, I would assume that most of the people in these professional firms, architects, engineers, are not necessarily by nature activists. They're, you know, they have careers, etc. And do these people feel isolated with regard to this? Do they, what is their attitude? I mean, do they feel more comfortable about speaking out now that you have this organization, for instance?
I think that helps a great deal. I was in isolation before this organization existed, and I didn't find it very comfortable to speak to my colleagues. They thought I was nuts. But when I could get them in front of the evidence graphically, you can't just talk to somebody about this. You actually have to see it. They begin to, the glazing over their eyes melts and their focus, and you can see their heart kind of slump at the reality of what it is that we're actually talking about here, because it is extraordinary. If what we're saying is true, the implications are staggering for our entire socioeconomic, political structure in this country, because I mean, you can't assume that these things are true and then go on with life as normal, because it says that the world, our country, our government is not safe anymore, and that's a fundamental dichotomy in our own psychology. So we defend that.
Right, not that they're just not safe, but suddenly things aren't what people thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very challenging now. Have you seen architects and engineers get politicized by this?
There are a number of activist architects and engineers among our... I'm not the only one speaking around. There's a number of us who are spending all of our free time speaking around the country, speaking, calling into radio talk show hosts, writing articles, talking to the other building professionals. We have fire protection engineers that have joined our organization, some who work for cities, chief fire protection engineers in the South Bay, and more and more so. In fact, the fire protection engineer who was the head of one of the divisions at NIST highly questioned the NIST report that came out in 2005. And that's Dr. Quintier. Very, very important series of professionals are waking up.
I'm speaking with architect Richard Gage. Today's show, 9/11 Blueprint, The Architecture of Destruction. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So let me tell you what kinds of evidence...
Well, you know, Richard, you've already mentioned, and I wanted to back up to this, since you've already mentioned intergranular melting, that's quite a mouthful. So let's talk about that. Now, I wanted to ask you, I watched your two-hour presentation that you gave at the University of Manitoba. It's on video, and it's called Why the Towers Fell. Now, in that speech, you refer to some of the experimentation that Dr. Stephen Jones has done, and that he has in his possession dust samples from Ground Zero. What was discovered in the pulverized dust residue at Ground Zero?
Well, you mentioned a couple of really important items. Intergranular melting, first of all. FEMA finds that that down to the grains of steel, steel's manufactured and chemically and microscopically that has grains, and in order for these grains to melt across their boundaries, you need temperatures that exceed 2,700 degrees, which is the beginning melting point of steel. Well, guess how hot the fires are in the top of the World Trade Center? NIST claims 1,800 degrees, first of all. Well, most office fires are about 12 to 1,400 degrees. But let's say that if that were true, there's still 1,000 degrees of heat missing to cause intergranular melting and the tons of molten metal that the firemen saw, and by the way, the structural engineer of the World Trade Center, Leslie Robertson, saw as well. It It's missing. So there's no explanation from the official story or anybody defending it where all of this molten metal came from. When it cooled, it formed these huge meteorites, they were calling them, and they'd pull these out, and they're sitting in a hangar at JFK Airport, tons of solid, previously molten metal. And by the way, Dr. Jones, whom you mentioned, was sent some slag from, well, a 40-pound chunk of this molten metal. What did he find in it? Well, it's predominantly iron, so it's not the remnants of an airplane, aluminum. It's got the trace chemical signature of thermite, which has sulfur and zinc and fluorine and manganese are all there in the exact or very, very near the same proportion as you find in the chemical analysis of thermite. Thermite includes sulfur. It's a high-tech form of thermite, so it's more explosive and may, in fact, been responsible for the explosive force that hurled these beams laterally 500 feet out of the Twin Towers. So he's also sent dust samples, for instance, from Jeanette McKinley, who had an apartment across the street from the World Trade Center. Her whole apartment was filled with this dust. I have some of it myself. And what Dr. Jones did is he put a magnet in all of these tiny little perfectly spherical metallic microspheres, he called them, came up to the top to the magnet, and they range in size very, 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 very small, up to the size of a BB. What in the world is this? All the dust samples have these. Well, he analyzes it, finds it's predominantly iron, finds that most of them are hollow, finds that the same chemical trace signature of thermite in them. And so, well, how did that form? Well, if there was thousands of cutter charges placed at these column-to-beam connections throughout the height of this building. Remember, it's 110 stories high, 1,368 feet and 208 feet across. If all the core columns, core-to-core and core-to-beams, were cut, and then almost simultaneously there was another explosive force, that would have atomized this molten iron and just spread it out. And as it was cooling, its surface temperature would form into a sphere. In fact, that's how they used to make the rifle musket bullets. I forget what they call them, musket balls, I guess. In the Revolutionary War, they drop molten lead off of a high tower. It forms into perfectly round, which is what raindrops are, actually. And so he finds the same constituents in those. In fact, the tops of the cars surrounding the World Trade Center are all corroded, and nobody knows where did all this corrosion come from. Well, this explains it. I mean, we're talking about highly corrosive stuff with these atomized thermite. And he also found the same thing in a piece of slag from the ends of these beams, because FEMA found what FEMA found at the ends of these beams, and what the demolition workers, as they was pulling these beams out, they would be dripping with molten metal.
Now, Richard, to clarify, the molten metal would have come where the thermite cutter charges sliced through the steel, right? We're not talking about melted columns. We're simply talking about melted cuts, right?
And we know that because Dr. Jones found very little chromium in this molten iron. So it's not structural steel that has been melted by the ton. Some of it certainly was melted as it was cut through, but these huge chunks of meteorites pulled out of the rubble at the base of the towers were all molten iron.
So then there was a considerable amount of molten metal in the pits below all three buildings, the Twin Towers and Building 7.
Yeah, all three buildings. And it's overwhelming evidence for the use of thermite, because thousands of these cutter charges would produce tons of this molten. And you can see it actually in the video, some of them in the collapse videos, if you will.
So now the cutter charges would have sliced through the columns, and then the explosive force would have shot the sliced beams out horizontally. I believe that you can kind of see that in the videos, right?
Yes. In fact, they're impaling themselves on surrounding buildings, as I mentioned, 500 feet away in a 1,200-foot diameter around the buildings. And guess what? What's found at the bottom of the towers? Where we'd be looking for 110 floors of 4-inch thick concrete, an acre in size, 208 by 208. So think of your home, and if it's a quarter acre, multiply it times 4, that's the area of one floor, times 100 stacked on top of each other. You'd expect to see floor trusses, metal decking, which is what they pour the concrete on each of these floors, all found down at the bottom. Well, maybe the kinetic energy destroyed a few of them, or half of them. You'd expect to find 50, but you don't even find one of these floors, and they were looking for them.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What they didn't find in the rubble pile that was stories high after the towers came down, what didn't they find that they should have found?
I would have expected that they would find about 1 million file cabinets, which are very, very dense, and they don't find any file cabinets down at the bottom. In fact, in the dust sample that I got from Jeanette McKinley across the street from the World Trade Center, when I put a magnet to it, I find lots of tiny, tiny metal filings. It's extraordinary. I mean, really small. You can barely see them, and they rise to the top. And what did they find on top of the Deutsche Bank building? Human remains, bone fragments, less than a half an inch long, 700 of them. Now, you tell me how 700 bone fragments that size can make their way in a gravitational collapse scenario over 100 feet laterally and so small so as to land on this building. And, of course, it's not the only building they landed on. They found human remains outside of Ground Zero.
Now, the official explanation for why these buildings came down, specifically Twin Towers, were planes crashed into them. There were fires. The fires weakened the core steel beams, and they collapsed. And in one report, they blame it on trusses. In another report, they blame it on column failure, etc. Could you describe the characteristics of fire damage versus that of controlled demolition, particularly with regard to steel frame buildings? I mean, a fire damage to a building has quite different characteristics than a controlled demolition, doesn't it?
Yeah, fire is a gradual process. When fires bring buildings down, and they have never brought high-rise steel-framed buildings down, talk about a wood building, for instance, you know, in 20 minutes, it'll move on to another source of fuel. And there's a cooling where the fire was. And this is true in high-rises, even though they don't collapse. The fire moves, cools, heats up another place, uses up the fuel, moves on. So you would expect an asymmetrical collapse if there was going to be a collapse. And in the 100 examples of high-rise fires we have, there isn't one that has collapsed. Part of this is because the fireproofing protects the steel, but we have several examples of very hot, very large, and very long-lasting fires in high-rise buildings.
And these would be steel-frame buildings, right?
Yes. And the other reason, by the way, that these buildings have not collapsed is because of the properties of steel. Steel is very dense. It wicks away. It conducts the temperature, the heat, throughout the building, actually, away from the hottest point. So even if there were, for instance, a 1,400-degree fire, as FEMA had claimed, and NIST upped it to 1,800 degrees, that would have been immediately dissipated throughout the building, even if some of the fireproofing was knocked off of core columns. The floor trusses are a different matter. They're very light, and so that's where FEMA and NIST chose to pinpoint the vulnerability in the building.
I'm speaking with architect Richard Gage, AIA. Today's show, 9/11 Blueprint, The Architecture of Destruction. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, I've been asked many times how could anybody have gotten into this building to set these charges?
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Obviously, if there were charges set, cutter charges or whatever sorts of charges, they would have most logically been set right on the core columns themselves, the steel core of the building. Now, is there access available to these core columns?
Well, it turns out that the 50 or so elevators that rise throughout this building and reducing in number toward the top, each of them are adjacent to one of these core columns. So it's actually quite easy to, within the elevator shaft, cut through the gypsum board, fire protective layer that surrounds the elevator cabs, and wire or place these cutter charges. And by the way, they do now quite commonly use wireless, so you wouldn't be running wires all over the place necessarily, especially in a what would probably have been quite a high-tech operation.
You're talking about wireless in order to set the charges off.
Yeah. So, but who would have had access to the elevator's shafts? And we know, for instance, that Ace Elevator had a modernization program going on in the 9 months prior to 9/11.
Were these elevators made by Ace Elevator?
I don't know if they were made. They were certainly modernizing them and upgrading them. They may very well have been replacing the cabs. There's an article on it in Elevator World, and we'll put that that article on our website so everybody can see it.
So a company called Ace Elevators was upgrading what, the elevators themselves in the 9 months prior to September 11th?
And all the hoisting equipment to make it safer. I mean, this building's been around since the late 60s, so they do age, and there's a need for higher tech equipment and stronger, safer systems. So that's a possibility. I'm not blaming Ace Elevator. I don't know. These are the things we need to find out and why we are demanding a new investigation. There's thousands of questions that must be answered. We don't have all the answers. We have a lot of very good questions.
What evidence is there of foreknowledge of the collapses, and not only of the Twin Towers, but of Building 7?
Yeah, well, very interestingly, in Building 7, the police and firemen were moving the public back well before 3 o'clock. This building came down at 5:20 in the afternoon. There are plenty of examples of, well, some first responders and paramedics discussing that they were told that the building was actually going to come down. In the video that you referenced, How the Towers Fell, that was filmed in Manitoba, there's a video clip of a policeman actually saying, "The building's going to blow up. Rain and debris are going to come down." And so he's just point blank saying it's going to blow up. Larry Silverstein, for instance, said on public television, "There's been such a terrible loss of life, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it." And it's pretty clear that we assume he's talking about the building. But he came back later and said, it wasn't the building, I was talking about the firemen. Well, there was no firemen in the building. They were pulled out well before 2 o'clock, and many of them are wondering, talking to each other, why aren't we putting out this fire? They knew it was going to come down.
Did then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani have foreknowledge of it?
Well, Rudy Giuliani had said to Peter Jennings that he got word that the World Trade Center Tower, the South Tower, was going to collapse 10 minutes before it did, to quote. And so he knew, but he didn't tell the firemen. Back to Building 7, again, the BBC announced that the building collapsed at 5 o'clock. And right behind Jane Stanley, the BBC reporter, she's saying it collapsed, and there's over her left shoulder is Building 7 still standing. So they must have had a script, right? Because you don't make mistakes like that. But that's what they said. "Oh, we're sorry. This was a mistake. We got confused in all of the confusion of the day."
Well, how soon before the building actually came down did she make that statement?
20 minutes.
So 20 minutes later than it actually did come down.
Yeah. Yeah. They must train in psychic powers at the BBC.
Is there evidence that FEMA was on the site the day before the planes crashed into the Twin Towers?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, they had their Exercise Tripod 2, which is a chemical and or biological attack that they were training for the day before 9/11. Thousands of FEMA members were on site in Lower Manhattan for this exercise, and Tom Kenny is one of FEMA's people, quoted as saying, "We were ready to go. We were the first ones to go into action." And of course, FEMA did take over the site, to the chagrin of many of the firemen and the fire protection engineers who wanted to understand how this collapse could have occurred. Remember, never before in history had a high-rise building come down, and here's FEMA directing the carting away of all of this structural steel, which is evidence in a crime scene, at 800 truckloads a day. They're carting it out of there. And Bill Manning, the editor of Fire Protection Magazine, is screaming in his editorials. And this is the magazine that all of the fire protection engineers get and receive and communicate back and forth with each other. And he's saying, this is an outrage. I forget the exact quote. "You've got to go and thumb through the PowerPoint presentation on the website and see this series of quotes from him. It's a scathing review, alluding to the fact that there is a cover-up."
On Tuesday night at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, Tuesday night, September 11th, 2007, at 7 p.m., you are going to be giving a presentation, and you have invited architects and engineers. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're going to talk about?
Yes. In fact, this presentation will follow 2 days of excellent films on broader subjects surrounding 9/11, as well as the collapse of these three high-rise buildings. And I'll be joined by Ed Muniak, a fire protection engineer for the city of San Jose. And he will be discussing in detail a lot of this evidence relative to what fires can and can't do to buildings and how buildings should look when they come down by fire and how they don't. So I'm just delighted that our members in increasing numbers are stepping up, and particularly fire protection engineer, very well qualified individual, Ed. And so we're going to step through point by point, starting with Building 7, all of this evidence, and you'll see it with your eyes rather than just hearing it. You'll find that it's very difficult information to take in, and that's because of the auxiliary issues that it brings up. But we're going to take on as many of the technical questions afterward, and there'll be some people there who will be more willing than myself to speculate as to who, why, how, where.
So you're going to have an audio-visual presentation as well, right?
It's a rather dynamic multimedia presentation, PowerPoint, and we have lots of video clips, audio, and I go through all of it. And then we get to the Twin Towers. It's even more interesting because as different of a type of demolition that the Twin Towers were, and as much as we never suspected, most of us, the demolition of them, the evidence is even stronger than Building 7. Building 7 being more obvious, the evidence for the Twin Towers demolition being stronger.
Now, when you go on a Friday at lunchtime to an architectural firm or an engineering firm and you give a presentation, what do you do? Do you do that within an hour on people's lunch hour?
Yeah, we get an hour and we start, and right away, as soon as they start biting into the sandwiches, and we wrap it up in 45 minutes, and there's a time for question and answer, and it's like dropping a bomb, if you'll pardon a pun, horrible pun. And it is difficult information to deal with. I can only imagine what some of your listeners might be thinking and feeling about hearing some of this for the first time, as I was as well. It's shocking. When people join our site, we ask them to provide a statement. And it's just really sad sometimes what I read. I read every one of the new members' statements. And they're shocked, they're dismayed, they're willing to do anything now to get to the rest of the truth, because this is just the beginning, these buildings. What about the hijackers? So there's lots of questions about the 19 fundamentalist hijackers. Why are 8 of them still alive, as reported by The Guardian, BBC, and many others?
So let me ask you this. What motivates you to do this? Obviously, you've started this organization Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. You're spending an awful lot of time giving presentations. I'm amazed myself. You seem to be giving one every night. What motivates you to do this work?
I would just have to say that I'm being driven from a place deep within that I have to answer to because of the strength of that guidance. It's taken quite a toll on my life. My marriage has not been the same, and quite possibly might not survive it. I have very, very, very little free time anymore. But the greatest joy, it's just been a great joy to take risks, to reach out to people. And when they do see what's really going on and their eyes light up, I'm like, oh, yes, this one person was worth it, because he is going to go and tell the truth to three, four, five other individuals. And it just all becomes worth it. Even when somebody, without even being willing to look at the evidence, will email me and call me a tinfoil hat wearing kook. It used to bother me quite a bit, actually. And the rewards are deep and internal, and I float on those. I'm being risen by this sense of mission, and we're it's not about money. There's no money here. It's just this deep sense of mission. That's all I can say. I'm on my game, and I can't be stopped. The truth is unstoppable, and the truth is what feeds me. I love this country. I don't want to see this country turned upside down by the people who carried out, planned and carried out 9/11. I don't want to see our country be turned into a police state, because, as we know, 9/11 gave rise to the loss of our sacred freedoms in the Patriot Act 1, the Military Commissions Act, and the second Patriot Act that they're trying to roll out.
You end your two-hour presentation, How the Towers Fell, with a quote from Martin Luther King. Could you repeat that quote?
Yeah. A time comes when silence is betrayal.
Richard Gage, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right. I've been speaking with Richard Gage, AIA. Today's show has been 9/11 Blueprint, The Architecture of Destruction. Richard Gage is an architect, a member of the American Institute of Architects, and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He is the originator of the Take an Architect to Lunch outreach program of 9/11 education for building professionals. Richard Gage has prepared a two-hour audiovisual presentation, How the Towers Fell, on the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7 destruction that took place on September 11th, 2001, and makes a strong case for controlled demolition. Richard Gage will give the keynote presentation on September 11th, 2007, at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. He will be joined by Ed Muniak, a fire protection engineer for the city of San Jose, California. Visit www.ae911truth.org for more information. That's www.ae911truth.org. Thanks to Laura Bourbon for recording today's interview. Guns and Butter is produced, edited, and mixed by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. Our engineer is Bonnie Bone. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.net. or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net. I'm Bonnie Faulkner, and I have a couple of important announcements. I will be MC at a two-day 9/11 film festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, Monday and Tuesday, September 10th and 11th, from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. both days. Monday night at 7 p.m. will feature the premiere of a new movie, Reflecting Pool, with the filmmakers in person. Tuesday night at 7 p.m., we'll feature a presentation by the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage, whom you have heard today. Each day's program begins with a 20-minute presentation by artist Jeanette McKinley, who provided the dust samples from Ground Zero to Dr. Stephen Jones for his experiments. The films shown in this two-day festival include Hijacking Catastrophe, Zeitgeist, Let's Get Empirical, The Reflecting Pool, 9/11 Press for Truth. Guns and Butter will be tabling in the lobby. I'll be there. Be sure to stop by. That's Monday and Tuesday, September 10th and 11th, 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. You can get complete program details at Richard Gage's site, www.ae911truth.org. That's ae911truth.org. Or you can also go to Carol Brouillet's website at www.communitycurrency.org. That's communitycurrency.org. I have a couple of more minutes of time, so maybe I can tell you a little bit more of the details of the films. At 1:20 on Monday, we're going to be showing Hijacking Catastrophe, and then after that film, Mickey Huff will give a short presentation on the film. Then at 2:45, we're going to show some films from the five-year anniversary of 9/11 in New York City with William Pepper and some of the first responders. Then at 4:05 on Monday, we're going to show Zeitgeist. That's a three-parter. That's a new movie. The first part is on religion, I understand. The second part, 9/11. The third part, on war. Then the evening program, Let's Get Empirical. That's a new film of David Ray Griffin, debunking 9/11 debunking. Then a presentation, a short presentation by Ken Jenkins, the filmmaker. Then Reflecting Pool at 7:30. And then that's going to be followed by a presentation of the filmmakers. Again, on Tuesday, September 11th, we're going to hear from Jeanette McKinley at 1 p.m. Then 9/11 Press for Truth will play at 1:20. Paul Ray will discuss that afterwards. Then 9/11 Mysteries at 3 o'clock. At 4:30, Jim Hoffman will give a short presentation, Jim Hoffman on 9/11 Mysteries. Then we're going to show Reflecting Pool again. That's going to show at 4:50. The filmmakers will be there again on Tuesday afternoon. And then, of course, the evening's program at 7 p.m. will be Richard Gage, whom you heard today, along with someone from the San Jose Fire Department. That's going to be our complete program, and I hope as many of you can come as I'd like to see everyone. A short announcement about the Guns and Butter website. Guns and Butter is looking for a webmaster and website designer. Please email me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at GUNSANDBUTTER.NET if interested.
It's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I'm Aaron Glantz, here to tell you about a new website launched by KPFA, The War Comes Home, online at warcomeshome.org. Joshua Castile is a former U.S. Army interrogator at Abu Ghraib.
I was constantly being asked, tell me about freedom, about democracy, why am I being held here? I want answers. And the detainees were the ones who were wanting answers, but that was our job. We were supposed to be finding answers to our questions.
You can hear the rest of Joshua Castile's story and other true stories of American veterans online at warcomeshome.org. That's www.warcomeshome.org.
This is 94.1 FM KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno, online worldwide.